Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Intellectual Property Practice Group, was recorded on November 6, 2012, during a live telephone conference call. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on software patents. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We have a guest moderator for today's call, Professor Mark Schultz of Southern Illinois University School of Law. And most importantly, from my perspective at least, Professor Schultz is a longtime member of the Federalist Society's Intellectual Property Practice Group Executive Committee. So thank you, Professor, for those years of service, and thank you for moderating our telephone call today. His more complete bio is available on our website, and it was provided to you in the notice for today's call. So without a further introduction, I'm going to turn things over to our moderator, Professor Schultz.
Thank you, Dean. As those of you who found your way to this call know, we're here today to discuss the question, software patents, are they a boon or bane for technological innovation? Since, of course, you found your way to the call, I won't repeat the brief description we've given of our discussion today, but rather proceed right to the discussion. Today we'll be joined by Adam Mossoff of George Mason University School of Law, then David Olson of Boston College Law School, and Robert Sachs, who is a partner at Fenwick West. I will introduce each of them as they begin to speak. Each will speak for about 5 to 7 minutes. We'll have a brief period where the participants exchange views, and then we'll open the floor to questions. So I'll begin now. Adam Mossoff, as I said, is a professor at George Mason University School of Law, where he teaches patent law, property law, and a wide range of related courses. Professor Mossoff is a leading scholar of the history and philosophy of patent law and a frequent participant in today's policy debates on patents. His historical work on past patent wars, so-called patent thickets, and patent pools is particularly renowned for the insights it provides into today's patent controversies. Professor Mossoff, I'm happy to turn it over to you.
Thank you, Mark, and it's a pleasure to be here today to speak on this topic and to take the break from the election day stress. I'm going to start off our teleform today with a historical perspective, a little bit of a potted history summary overview of the development of the IP protections for software. Specifically, I'd like to talk about the shift from copyright to patent protection. I think this historical perspective is important because it reveals, if anything, that complaints about the intellectual property protection for software is nothing new, that such complaints and debates have existed from the get-go. And it also very much reveals how the shift from copyright to patent was not actually a product of strategic rent-seeking firms and others seeking to exploit their access to halls of power in Congress or to the courts, but actually it represented a natural progression and a natural development of both the doctrine and the technology as it evolved from the 1960s up through the late 1990s. Well, the story begins actually, as we know, with the digital revolution in the late 50s and early 1960s. And at the time the software started to be developed, we actually forget today that the proposition that software is protected by copyright was actually heavily disputed for much of the 1960s and 1970s, which is a little bit ironic given that today people often state that we don't need patent protection for software because, oh, of course, copyright protects software. Well, that was not always a given in the law. In 1964, the Register of Copyrights started to register copyright protection for software code. However, it was heavily disputed, and there was substantial public policy debate about this. And ultimately, it was not resolved until 1980 when Congress actually passed specific legislation authorizing the protection of software code under the Copyright Act. Now, it's significant that this occurred in 1980 because, as we all know, the late 1970s and early 1980s marks the start of the PC revolution. Now, what's significant about the PC revolution is that it marks the shift away from the union of hardware and software as a unified single device to hardware and software becoming distinct products. So software now becomes a product, a box that you used to buy on the shelves, an egghead software stores, for those who remember those stores before they went out of business, and long before we could easily download these programs in 30 seconds over the internet. And now, the significance of software becoming this separate product that was sold in Egghead software stores and in being capable of running on different machines was that the value in software, which is what the consumer was seeking, was the function of a program as experienced by the end user at that time. Typically, you know, it was experienced, for instance, in the GUI, you know, the graphical user interface. For instance, the pull-down menu in a word processing program. So you have a word processing program with lots of functions in it where you could do editing, italicizing, and things of that sort. And that was the value in this product that was being sold to the consumers. Now, the problem that starts to evolve in the 1980s with the software revolution, of course, is that you can replicate the user interface or the function of a particular program without copying the literal code that originally created that same user interface. So the code is distinct from the user interface or the function of the program itself. Now, this issue was brought to a head in the copyright realm in the famous case of Lotus v. Borland, which was originally filed as a copyright infringement lawsuit in 1990 by Lotus, which was the maker of the very famous spreadsheet Lotus 1-2-3, which sued Borland for copying its pull-down menus that were used in that spreadsheet program. The case is ultimately decided and resolved by 1995, with the courts holding that pull-down menus are purely functional, and therefore they're not protected by copyright. They're not expressive work. So what this proposition established is that by the early 1990s, as signified by the Borland Lotus v. Borland case, is that copyright could no longer adequately secure the material value that was created in software programs. This material value being the experience of the program and the functionality of the program that the consumer, the end user, was purchasing it for to use on their machine, whether it be a Apple computer or a Windows machine, or even back in the 1980s, an IBM PC. And this thus explains why at that same time you had a significant shift to patent protection. And in fact, at the same time that the Lotus v. Borland case was ongoing, you had the ultimate decision at the Federal Circuit in 1994 in Re Allopat, where the Federal Circuit upholds Pure Software finally as a patentable invention, and where in fact analogizes software to the equivalent of a digital machine. Now, Allopat is significant, I think, because it also highlights a problem with the rhetoric today of the so-called patent software problem, or the problem of software patents. And that is that a lot of this rhetoric actually is not very clear as to exactly what is the invented product or value that is being secured by the patent regime that is the exact problem. Because software, as recognized in the Allopat court decision, is just another machine, or you could characterize it also as a method, but the method that's captured physically in the functionality of the program is a method that's no different than any other invented method, going all the way back to the method of producing vulcanized rubber by Charles Goodyear, or the method of communicating dots and dashes that Samuel Morse patented in 1844 with his telegraph. And this raises a very important point, which I'll conclude with, which is that the success of the American patent system historically is that it has secured property rights, the exact same property rights, for all types of inventions. And if we start to discriminate against some types of invented values, and distinguishing between the types of machines or methods in one regime but as patentable but not in another, then what we are going to be creating here is a disaster for the patent system, because you will be incentivizing rent-seeking and incentivizing, ultimately, the patent system to be starting to make arbitrary distinctions between types of inventions, and that will have significant impact on the innovation that our patent system secures. So, thank you.
Thank you, Adam. Next, we will be hearing from David Olson. David Olson is a professor at Boston College Law School, where he teaches patent law, antitrust law, and other related topics. Professor Olson researches primarily in the fields of copyright and free speech and patent law. He's known for his work on patentable subject matter, taking a strongly utilitarian view of subject matter requirements based on the language of the Constitution's IP clause. Thank you, David. I'm delighted to turn it over to you.
Thank you, Mark. It's a pleasure to be here and to be talking about software patents, something that I do enjoy talking about very much and enjoy debating with Adam. We've had many disagreements over the years about this. I'd like to start by giving an overview and some of the history that Adam left out, and then I'll kind of try to keep my remarks there and maybe extend a bit in the after question and answer and whatnot. So I start, as Mark said, from the position of utilitarianism. Where do I get that? Well, I think it makes sense for patent law and copyright law, and it also, of course, comes right from the Constitution, which in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 8 says as follows: the Congress shall have power to promote the progress of science and useful arts by securing for limited times to authors and inventors the exclusive right to their respective writings and discoveries. So what the Constitution does is it gives Congress power for utilitarian ends. Nowhere does the Constitution recognize or promote a kind of natural rights approach to patent law or copyright law, and therefore it is very different and I think regulatory and incentive-based of IP rights rather than recognizing natural rights and property as we do in the common law in real property and chattel property. So indeed, the Constitution limits the rights that it gives in IP. It limits the rights they have to be given to inventors or to authors, and they have to be for limited times. So I think all of that's quite significant, and we should keep that in mind. Moreover, I think that if we look at software patents, there are a few main points that we should keep in mind. If we look at software from the point of view of a utilitarian perspective, I posit that software patents may not, and indeed in many cases likely are not at all needed to adequately promote the progress of the useful arts. Why is this? A few reasons. Number one, there are other means of recouping the investment in research and development and distribution of this software. What sort of other means? Well, Adam already mentioned one. As of 1980, it's been indisputable that software is copyrightable. The copyright protection lasts for 95 years from the date of publication, and so it's long, it's strong, it keeps anyone out there from going out and getting a copy of, say, Microsoft Word or Adobe Acrobat or any other program and simply copying it and redistributing it. Number two, trade secret law protects software. How? As anyone who's litigated or worked for a company that does any software at all, source code is closely and highly protected and guarded. It's very hard to get anyone to reveal their source code, and simply being able to copy machine code in violation of copyright law is not enough to really take someone else's code and in any meaningful way kind of reverse engineer it and start getting advantages from it. So trade secret protection coupled with copyright protection really protects companies from having their software ripped off, as it were. Third, there are ancillary means of recouping investments. We see this all the time, right? So advertising, links on websites, Google, Yahoo, lots of companies have very expensive software development programs that are completely funded by ancillary means and for software is not no patent or IP or no patent protection anyway is needed. Of course, Google, if it didn't have any way to protect its algorithms and source, would be in trouble. Fourth is complex software, of course, can also be developed without IP protection. Open source is a main example of this. I'm not sure, I'm certainly not a believer that we could do away with all IP rights and we'd have an adequate incentive to have as much software as is most beneficial to society. So I don't go that far, but it should give us pause and make us think a bit that quite complex software is developed and into complex ecosystems without any IP rights, in fact, with a prohibition on IP rights. So I just kind of throw that out for consideration. So that makes me conclude we may not need software patents to have adequate levels of software and software development and distribution. And in fact, if we then look more recently, and I think part of the reason we have the name for this panel of Boone or Bane, part of the Bane comes from how software patents have been used in more recent years. What's been going on, as people who follow this space at all know, software patents are among those types of patents that are most likely to be asserted by non-practicing entities, or as they're colloquially known by many people, as by trolls. So what are patent trolls? Patent trolls are generally defined as those who buy up a bunch of patents, don't make the product or process that goes with the patent, and instead go around and write letters, issue threats, sue various firms for purposes of rent extraction or basically holdup. Of course, there's a more charitable interpretation where these firms are returning the value to the inventors that they're owed because this is a patent that was duly granted, and therefore if someone else is using it, then the inventor should be paid for that. That's the argument that's more charitable. If that's the case, then it might be worth it, right? Even if we have all these lawsuits and these so-called patent trolls, that might well be worthwhile. It might be clearing the patent rights if it increases incentives enough as far as software development that it's worth the cost. But the evidence is rather contrary. So many firms that are involved in making software, their engineers don't read patents at all, and in fact, many firms actually prohibit their engineers from reading patents because they're afraid that they'll get sued and then hit with treble damages if they're aware of these other patents out there. Well, that's not how the patent system is supposed to work. The patent system is supposed to work in such a way that firms would read and be aware of what other people have done, and they would build on that and innovate further. But instead, it turns out that with software, a lot of times what's difficult is coming up with the idea and the business model and exactly what you want to do, and then coding the actual software to get there is kind of workmanlike. And so I don't want to say easy enough, but it's something that's doable. And I think one of the reasons that we've seen a lot of shift in the patent trolls, like, for instance, patents instead of copyright protection for software code, is that copyright only protects the exact expression of the code, so the code exactly as it is, whereas patents are granted at a higher level of abstraction. Patents are granted in such a way that if you're the one who comes up with a method of auto-updating your code so it sends out over the internet, updates your systems, if you're the first one to do that, you can kind of file a patent on that at a flowchart level, and then you can extract rent from anybody else who comes up with the same idea of doing that, even if the actual coding of it's rather simple. So that, I would submit, is somewhat problematic and gives us evidence that the benefit we're getting from software patents isn't equal to the cost. So, in fact, firms don't copy other people's software very often at all. You almost never see a copyright case, and in most of the patent cases, you don't see evidence of direct copying. Instead, you have these kind of fuzzy claim construction terms where people are arguing back and forth about whether this auto-updating program, you know, from the kind of maybe, you know, early 2000s, late 1990s that was designed for a different system would also cover, you know, Microsoft's auto-update feature. So that's kind of the Bain side, and I guess I'm out of time, so I will leave going into the history until perhaps later.
Thank you, David. Next, I'd like to introduce Robert Sachs, who is a partner in the San Francisco office of Fenwick and West. His practice concentrates on strategic patent counseling and prosecution for software technologies. He's prosecuted a number of well-known patents and helped design business models and licensing strategies for several prominent inventors of business methods and software. He's also the primary patent evaluator for various patent pools on today's most important audio, video, and communications technologies, including 802.11, MPEG-4, AAC, and DVB-MHP. Robert, I'm happy to turn it over to you.
Thank you. So let me, I think David's comments provide a good jumping off point. David acknowledged that the value is often in the idea, the fundamental concept in a software product, and that the coding is not necessarily easy, but it's workmanlike. And that was what Adam was getting at as well, when Adam was talking about the user experience, and that what people want is the user experience, the Lotus 1, 2, 3 menus, for example. And it's interesting historical footnote that I was one of the very first attorneys to work on the Lotus versus Borland case right after I started and did the user interface analysis that was eventually used in the litigation. I want to generalize Adam's point, though. It's not merely user experience. It's that functionality, the value, what we see, and not just in software, but in anything we want, anything we consume, anything that humans need, is in the functional value, whether that is a software application, whether that's Instagram on your phone, or whether that is a pen in your hand, or whether it was, you know, a spearhead carved out of stone 100,000 years ago. It's the functional value that humans seek in the artifacts we create, and that patents, from a first principle standpoint, protect that functionality and that structure. So where David acknowledges that copyright and by law does not protect functionality, and then says we have other mechanisms, well, we have copyright for the code, well, that's an explicit acknowledgement that what you're not really protecting the value, the functional value in the software. And the very fact that you can create that functional value and replicate that functional value using multiple different code bases is further evidence of that. So I think that when it comes to a first principle analysis and one looks at what it is that patents protect and what is the things that humans want in artifacts, it's that functionality. So then turning there from whether it's needed to promote, do you need software patents to promote software development? And I'll clearly admit, I'll be one of the first people to admit as a software patent attorney, the answer is no. I've had the smallest number of clients who didn't invest in their technology because they couldn't get a patent. And then those that did, it was typically in physical products. It wasn't in software. The problem, however, with deciding which categories of technologies do we need from a utilitarian analysis is it's ex ante. And you can't know ahead of time which technologies will need protection by patents and which technologies don't. We're making this analysis today, you know, after many, many years, but we couldn't have known ex ante in the 90s or in the 80s whether software or biotech or any other industry is the kind of thing for which we can have you need patent protection. So there's a cart before the horse, chicken and egg problem with deciding which categories are subject to patent protection and which ones are not, because you don't know at the time those technologies are coming to bear. So that's the problem with the general problem with the utilitarian calculus. Are software patents a bane? It's clear we have structural problems in the system. There's no question about that. But the problems are not necessarily the result of the fact that software itself is patentable. I think the problems arise from a number of other areas. For example, David mentions that firms prohibit their engineers from reading patents because of the specter of treble damages. Well, I think that's a perfect example of the tail wagging the dog, and I'm very much against those types of problems in general. We have had extreme doctrines in terms of willful infringement, for example, that cause those types of results. We have other problems in claim construction doctrines, which end up with requirements that software, for example, be claimed as an artificial machine rather than a method, because methods aren't infringed unless the device is actually operating. So we have a number of doctrines in the patent law and claim construction and infringement that end up having adverse or odd consequences and that drive then strategic behavior. So that is part of why we have very strange claim formats, computer program products. We have arguments about that. So if we maybe looked at whether software is patentable per se as an artifact, I think it's just like any other. But whether what would be the right mechanisms for enforcing it? And I would agree, for example, that maybe patent terms need to be adjusted across the board. The 17 years and now 20 from filing date is a complete artifice. And just pulled out of a hat, particularly at a time when the lifespans of technologies were radically different from what they are today. So there definitely could be adjustments in terms of the implementation of the system. And then one other footnote I'd make is part of the reason we are in this problem, i.e. we have so many software patents and they seem to be bad, is that even to this very day, the Patent Office does not recognize computer science or software engineering as a legitimate discipline. You cannot be a registered patent attorney just or a patent examiner by showing up and with your BS degree in computer science or software engineering. You have to go through a number of hoops. So for the very earliest time, the patent attorneys who wrote software patents and the examiners who examined them were not computer scientists. They were not computer programmers. They were not software engineers. They tended to be double E's. They tended to be in other disciplines and not have the fundamentals of training in the discipline. And so I think that led in part as well to a whole generation of poorly written software patents and a whole generation of poorly examined software patents. So there are deep institutional problems that I believe still persist to this day, just in the way the Patent Office organizes itself and manages its own operations in terms of software. So with that, I'll go ahead and reserve my remarks.
Well, thank you. So this is Mark Schultz, the moderator, coming in again. And what we'll do now is, what I'd like to do now is offer each panelist a chance to follow up for a minute or two on the remarks. If you'd like to ask a question of one of your fellow panelists at this time, that's fine as well. But let's turn this back over to Adam Wasoff for a moment, and then I'll follow through in the order in which each of you spoke.
Thank you, Mark. My panelists raised lots of different issues, but something that I'd actually like to touch upon, while perhaps reserving time later for responses to issues about trolls and utilitarianism and whatnot, is that I worry, and this builds upon Bob's remarks, about a nirvana fallacy that infects a lot of the complaints in, about the patent system today. I mean, as Bob indicated, you know, there's certainly doctrinal tweaks that can be done that could fix particular issues at particular points in the system. But it's very important to recognize that once we recognize a new type of invention as being the appropriate recipient of patent protection, of being secured as a property right, the PTO and judges cannot know ex ante with 100% certainty how the general principles of novelty, non-obviousness, usefulness, and written description will apply there. And so what you have to have is a time period in which the system has to learn. And the way it learns is by granting these patents at the Patent and Trademark Office, and then these patents are being challenged in the courts or being challenged in the post-issuance review procedures at the Patent and Trademark Office, and you get decisions on this is a good patent and this is a bad patent. And in fact, this historically has been the pattern. There are many similar complaints about early pharmaceutical patents at the turn of the 20th century about how we have no technical expertise about this. Very famous and learned judges like Judge Learned Hand complained incessantly in very famous cases like his decision in the Park Davis case, which is the foundation of all biotech patents today, that, you know, he says, I have no idea what the chemistry is and what the nature of the science is. We really need to have experts evaluate these things. This is confusing. This is costly and expensive, and this is imposing all these extra costs on the system. In fact, it's very funny because his complaints are mere complaints about software patents today. And yet, today, everyone who attacks software patents, such as Judge Posner in his recent blog postings and written comments in various journals, acknowledge that pharmaceutical patents are the perfect area where patents worked perfectly. And yet, if you go back 100 years ago, you had the exact same complaints about pharmaceutical patents that we now have about software patents. And so I would hope that people would at least recognize that legal system has to learn just like regular people. It's an institution that is staffed by regular people, and they have to acquire data. They can't know from some type of platonic form of the ideal patent and then just deduce from that how to secure property rights in software. That they can't do that right away. It takes time. It's an inductive process. And so I think that Bob makes an excellent point that we shouldn't let some of the detail concerns drive a more fundamental complaint about the patent system as such. That's the tail wagging the dog.
Well, thank you very much, Adam. And now I'd like to give David a chance to follow up. David Olson, can we hear from you for a few minutes?
Thank you. Yes, so this is an interesting conversation, and I appreciate the points made by the other members of the panel. I'd like to follow up on a couple of things. First, as to pharmaceutical patents, and people were afraid of them just like they are of software patents, I have some skepticism. I will bow to Adam as far as him being more of the historian of IP, but I think that we might find a lot of distinguishing features between the two, both practically and, in fact, in the history. But I'm not going to go into that here. What I would like to stress, though, is that there's one important thing that I'm not sure it's come out fully, but the fact is that in moving from non-patentability of software to patentability of software, there was never any kind of utilitarian calculus done to decide, well, this is a good idea. And in interpreting the Patent Act and in interpreting the Constitution and asking what are technological arts, what are the sorts of things that should be patentable or not, I mean, I've written on this in the past, but I believe that the courts came to this with a very much kind of common lawmaking role, and Congress in effect delegated that to them for a long time, and they made certain rules along the way, and to some extent they were utilitarian focused until in more recent decades they've turned away from that. So it's important to realize that, you know, did Congress ever authorize software patents? No, is the answer. Was there any ever study of whether software patents were a good idea? Well, way back in 1966, there was a presidential commission on the patent system. It concluded that software should not be patentable. In doing so, it rejected both the notions that there would be inadequate incentive and the line-drawing problems between hardware and software. Now, sure, that's, you know, all that time ago, but there's not, you know, no one's gone back to the well, really. Well, I shouldn't say that, but Congress or the executive hasn't really gone back to the well since then. In 1968, the Patent Office adopted guidelines against software patents. Nevertheless, then the Court of Customs and Patent Appeals slowly begins a process of rejecting some of the underlying doctrines, mental step doctrines and whatnot, and slowly kind of eating away at this prohibition on software patents. And this goes on over time through the case doctrine until eventually we get to the Supreme Court and in Diamond v. Deere in 1981, which kind of allows a computer program that's running an algorithm that's used in machinery that's used for curing synthetic rubber. The court says that's patentable, and then, as Adam said, the Federal Circuit by 1994 and In Re Allopat pretty much makes all software patentable. But we can go through all of that history, and you can see them looking at prior cases and looking at, you know, is this or that? Are we having line drawing problems? Would it be hard to do? But there's never a utilitarian kind of balance. Congress has never weighed in and said anything on this. It's kind of left it to the courts, has not been able to get around to doing that. So I just think the listeners should be clear that we've gotten to the point of software patents kind of by accretion and decisions about case law and about precedent that are very different than a purely utilitarian approach that would say, you know what, are we really getting more good out of software patents than we're getting cost? And on top of that, I'd point out the more recent trend, which has been that software patents are being accumulated and really asserted much more aggressively than they were 15 years ago. And so they are increasing the cost as we go along. And it might be a good time for Congress, especially, and as I've written in the past, maybe even courts, to think about that as we're deciding on the patentability of software patents.
Thank you very much, David. Now I will turn it over to Robert Sachs to hear his brief response. Thank you, Robert.
Thank you. So David talks about the accretion model and that there has never really been a focused utilitarian analysis. And I would posit, David, that as in a sense of a scientific analysis, you have a theory, and yet it's not supported necessarily that well by the evidence, i.e., you know, you have a whole history of case law of analysis, yet none of the entities involved is doing the utilitarian calculus, which may suggest that the utilitarian calculus, while it may be, you know, arguably there in the Constitution, is not really the way the law develops, and that it really is an accretion model, as Adam suggests. And I would take that further by saying, you know, we're totally comfortable with physical property rights in chattel and in regular property. But why are we? Because it took hundreds, maybe even 1,000 years of case law, you know, in every possible jurisdiction to make clear what the rights in physical property are. Well, we're undergoing that now in intangible property, and yet physical property hasn't changed. Intangible property keeps changes, new subject area, software, biotech, genes, pharmaceuticals, fuzzy hats, whatever you call it, that keeps changing. And so we have to keep going through this learning process, this inductive process of figuring out what the property right boundaries are when it comes to these types of intangibles. So we've done it. It took a long time, and that's why Adam teaches property law, but these are property rights, and yet every time the subject matter changes. So I don't think necessarily the utility calculus is actually what the law is based on, either in fact or in theory. The other thing that Adam pointed out, David, you talked about the move from non-patent to patent, but I actually dispute that. I don't think there was ever a move from non to patent. I would take the position that software has always been patentable, and it's only now that the tension is being turned against it. The Patent Office itself has always issued software patents either expressly or implicitly. If you go back, you can find software patents from the 60s, from the 50s, probably even so back as far as the 40s, certainly in the 70s and the 80s, well before there was any court decision. The decisions in Gottschalk versus Benson, for example, is widely misunderstood as being, you know, the first anti-software patent case at hand. That's entirely incorrect. The court quite clearly says that they are not deciding that no program would be, that a computer program cannot be patentable subject matter. Only that one in that case was not patentable subject matter. So there's been a widespread misunderstanding of what the case law even says. And what's very strange, I think, and is that the reason that Gottschalk versus Benson and Parker versus Fluke, where Stevens there held that an algorithm there for also very much like Deere for computing some variables in a chemical process was not patentable, is Stevens took the view that if he could, he'd have an unequivocal rule that anything that could not be used, any algorithm or any implementation that could not be used except in the context of a digital computer, was not patentable. So if you can only have a practical application by using it with a computer, it was not patentable. That is 100% in the other direction from where we are today, for example, with arguments in CyberSource, that computer programs are essentially mental steps and therefore not patentable subject matter. But Stevens had a bias against software. What was the source of his bias? Well, we don't know in fact, but I have a theory that Stevens came, which is based on the fact that Stevens himself came, he was in the Navy and he was in the crypto analysis group, and he dealt with people whose jobs titles were computers. And what they did was they compiled tables of numbers. And so to Stevens, a computer was just something that did mathematics. And if it was if that's all you were doing, that's not the kind of thing that is patentable. So I think we have a number of interesting historical markers as to what the turns of the tide were in the history of software patents, but it was never that they were not patentable and became patentable. They have always been patentable and now are under attack.
Thank you very much, Robert, and I appreciate the exchange among our panelists, but we also want to give a chance to our audience to ask questions. So at this point, I'll be turning this over to the Federalist Society staff to help us moderate the questions. So, Dean?
Sure. Thanks, Mark. We're going to open the floor now to your questions. It looks like right off the bat, Mark, we have two callers with questions. Should we go to the first question?
Absolutely.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. Seems if we are to follow the intent of the founders, we should perhaps focus on the word invention, and with implication that it be a non-obvious discovery or invention in order to follow the tradition that originally gave rise to the patent system. So then the question arises whether something implemented as software can be a non-obvious invention. And I am prepared to admit that there's a possibility of that, but that much of what is being patented, software that's being patented, is in fact obvious in the sense that if you were to put programmers to work to solve the problem that the software, the so-called the patented software, undertakes to solve, that you would invariably get very similar results from many different programmers if they all approach the same problem. And if that's the case, if the development of the software is a straightforward process rather than something that requires deep insight, then I think we should maintain that it is not patentable. Now, of course, most patent clerks aren't going to know how to evaluate that. I, as a programmer, do know how to evaluate that. Should we not reexamine the notion of software patentability from the viewpoint of non-obvious inventions and consider them non-obvious if any reasonably competent programmer would reproduce them?
May I answer that?
Certainly, Bob.
Thank you for your question. I think you raise a general concern that, gee, we look at a lot of these software patents and they're obvious to us as programmers. And I will acknowledge, as my mentor said, there has no patent that has been found invalid that wasn't first issued by the United States Patent and Trademark Office. So, yes, there's a lot of obvious patents out there. But we want to separate out the question of is software the kind of thing that is patentable? Okay, and is any one particular program the kind of thing that is patentable from is this particular program obvious? Now, as I said, part of the problem is the Patent Office itself has an institutional bias against hiring people who actually know the discipline, against hiring people who have software degrees. I have a master's in software engineering, and I didn't qualify immediately for the bar. I had to go through the option B route, which is much more complex. So the very fact that they don't have people who are software engineers or computer scientists is part of that problem, and I agree that there should be a higher scrutiny. However, we can't apply the rule that it has to be hard to do, because no area of patent protection is subject to that type of constraint. And there's lots of things. Invention is not based, and this has been well developed in the case law, invention is not based on how hard it is. That is not the test of invention. The test of invention is non-obviousness. And so it could be, and one of the things you're begging the question is when you said, well, if we stick a bunch of programmers on the problem, a lot of the invention is identifying the problem to begin with, to actually seeing there's a problem with the way things are. And that is where the inspiration comes from. That's where the innovation takes place. And once the problem is identified, yes, it may be relatively straightforward to code it. I mean, it may be even hard to code it, but it could be, it's workmanlike. But we've never had a test where how hard it is to create the thing is the test of invention. If that was it, you would throw out the vast majority of inventions, which are, once you've figured out what you want to do, any machinist could build the product. That's not the test.
Right. I mean, just to build upon Bob's excellent response, that obviously this is a term of art in patent law. It's not just, you know, what, you know, I happen to subjectively think it is totally obvious, because the problem with that is that everything, once it's created, in retrospect, is totally obvious. And in fact, the genius of the American patent system was through this kind of incremental development to develop this distinction between novelty and non-obviousness through the case law in the 19th century, to recognize that these are two different types of inquiries. And the reason why you need these two types of inquiries is partially because there are very, very valuable inventions that are very small incremental contributions to the existing art. But nonetheless, that small incremental contribution is itself a huge leap forward in terms of the value contribution that it makes. As the aphorism that I usually deploy with my students is that in obviousness doctrine, it's not the difference, it's the difference that the difference makes. And the I think as Bob has rightly pointed out, the majority of the of patent inventions, and very successful patent inventions, are not what we call these pioneering leaps forwards, but actually in fact are small developments upon prior creative efforts that in fact have contributed value and have brought significant value to the end users and consumers of the world.
Thanks. I expect that David may have a thought or two on this issue as well. David Olson?
Yes, thanks, Mark. Absolutely. Obviousness is a complex inquiry, and there could well be non-obvious software patents as well as many obvious ones. What I'd like to throw out in response to the co-panelists, and maybe they can think about it in conjunction with the next question, is just a basic question of whether these software patents, you know, whether we're getting more benefit than we're getting cost from them, and how so. And so getting down in the weeds and asking whether a particular patent, a software invention is obvious or not, of course, is necessary for the patent office to do, and it's continued to have problems with that. But at a higher level, I think there's an issue with how much they're necessary, especially if, and I haven't heard a lot of dispute, the fact is that most people who are writing software out there are not looking at other people's software code, or not, you know, they may be paying attention to some of the functionality of their competitors, as Bob was saying. But if we're really wanting to get to the level where we're protecting pure functionality, then we have a really aggressively protective IP rights for software, because we have both copyright protection, which lasts 95 years, and patent protection, which lasts 20 years. And usually in copyright, we'll say through the idea expression dichotomy that you can protect your expression, i.e. in this case the code, but not the overall idea, so the function. Here we seem to be saying both, and my question is whether it's worth it. And of course, Bob was right that we haven't seen the case law develop in the Federal Circuit and even Supreme Court from a utilitarian basis. I wasn't denying that. I'm saying that's problematic.
We'd like to let another questioner ask a question, but I'll,
absolutely,
I'll certainly let all of you respond to one another. Dean, there was at least one further question.
We have two questions now in the queue, and before we go to
great.
That, let me make a quick programming announcement. The Federal Society of National Lawyers Convention is hosted next Thursday, Friday, and Saturday here in Washington, D.C. Details of that event, including information on how to register, you can find on our website. And our next scheduled Teleforum conference call is going to be the week following. That'll be on Tuesday, November 20th at 2 p.m., when we'll be discussing religion and strict scrutiny with Federalist Society founding board member Stephen Calabresi. And for a schedule of upcoming Teleforum calls and other Federalist Society events, you can consult the Federalist Society's website. So, Mark, with two more questions, we'll go to the next caller.
This is David Applegate in Chicago, where it's election day and we vote early and often. That reminds me that in addition to electing a president today, we are electing a new Congress. Given that Congress has already passed the America Invents Act, do any of the panelists see anything coming down the pipe legislatively in the next congressional term that may affect the patentability or enforceability of software patents?
This is David. No, definitely not. I think they've had enough of that, and I think we're going more to the principle of things here than something we're going to see legislated soon.
developed.
Yeah, I somewhat disagree with David's remarks, if only because there has been extensive pushes for additional patent legislation just this year, despite the fact that the AAIA passed last year. I mean, so we had a very substantive, non-technical, technical corrections bill on the AIA that was attempted to be pushed through Congress this past summer. There's been actually proposed bill on the floor now, the House, of a plaintiff patentee loser pay system to creating that for in the trial system. And, of course, there's the ongoing disputes, and there's a draft bill floating around with respect to the ability of patent owners to seek remedies at the International Trade Commission. With the extensive, very heavy coverage of the problem of software patents of late, including the, as I said, the ongoing commentary from Judge Posner, the New York Times article last month, upcoming conferences that are dedicated solely to the proposition of the, quote, problem of software patents, unquote, I frankly would be surprised if we don't see an attempt in some quarters to actually push through a bill addressing software patents in the coming Congress.
Thank you, Adam. And I guess at this point we'll try another question. Dean?
Okay, one more question from our audience.
Now, my question to the speakers, and anyone can really take this on, is whether or not they view that adopting a period of contestability similar to what's used in the trademark space in the patent area would give us a better quality filter on software patents.
Mark, I would like to just a first stab at that, because there's several claims were made about the uniqueness of software patents as both a subject matter and as an historical matter that some of my research has actually directly addressed. So is it okay with the others if I just go first on this?
Go right ahead.
Sure. Yes. Obviously, I was only speaking of one aspect of how early pharmaceutical patents reflect some of the complaints about today's software patents. I mean, obviously, no two cases are exactly the same. If they are, it's not an analogy. It's an identity proposition. And so one can always obviously identify other aspects that are slightly different or were not covered by the initial comparison. And yes, there is more overlapping incremental development perhaps in software patents than in early pharmaceutical patents. Well, that's an interesting empirical question that actually I don't think anyone has established the empirical truth of the matter. Right now that's a nice intuition, but whether that's actually true or not as an historical matter has yet to be established. But what I do know for a fact is, and what is historically inaccurate, is the claim that software is somehow unique or special because it does involve lots of overlapping patent rights and involves incremental innovation. The history of the American patent system from the get-go has been a system in which inventions have involved substantial overlapping patent rights over singular products in which there have been incremental contributions and steps made. In fact, as Mark mentioned at the start of this teleform, my research in the invention of the sewing machine in the 1830s and 40s was exactly this phenomenon. The sewing machine was the iPhone and tablet computer of its day, which resulted in multiple owners having different patents and different components of it, and it resulted in the very first patent war called at the time the Sewing Machine War of the 1850s. And then you had follow-on patent wars with the invention of the incandescent light bulb. You had a patent war with respect to electrical systems between Edison and Tesla and Westinghouse. You had patent wars with respect to the airplanes, with respect to radio. All the way coming up into the 1980s, you had patent wars with respect to disposable diapers and the stent wars. As if you talk to any patent lawyers who were working at that time, they can tell you great stories about the hundreds of millions of dollars in damage awards that were issued in the diaper wars, which is a multi-billion-dollar industry, just as the software industry is today. So it's simply not true as an historical matter, and this we have actual empirical evidence on, that software is a somehow unique subject matter that presents unique problems that are not faced by other patentable subject matters through history or up through today.
Yeah, I mean, think of how many patents there are involved in that overlap in your car, right? One of the most complex objects that you use on a daily basis is your automobile, or in an airplane, or trains, or in any other complex physical mechanical system. There are thousands, hundreds of thousands of patents easily in any one of those domains. So I agree, it's not true that software is somehow unique in that sense. In fact, you see a lot on the forums from software developers saying, you know, I'm scared that I'm going to be, you know, that every line of code I write is covered by a patent, and I don't want to start up a business because of that. That's complete nonsense. The notion that every line of someone's code Every function a program is subject to patent is evidence of the fear and uncertainty that has been propagated by the anti-patent crowd. If software developers are fearing that, that can't simply be what's going on. That can't be the real world, because in the real world here in the Silicon Valley, there's 100 new startups every single day, and they're going into business, and they're not being sued into the ground by either trolls or Google or Apple or Microsoft. So I think that what we have is this generation of fear and misinformation.
Thank you. David, your thoughts on this?
Sure. So I guess a couple of thoughts. I take the points of Bob and Adam for the most part, and Adam's article on the Sewing Machine Wars is fantastic. I really enjoyed reading it and have used it in my work. So, yeah, of course, there are lots of areas where you have lots of overlapping patents. That's how patent law works. But if you recall, I made a point slightly different a while back, which is there are not lots of areas where you have overlapping copyright and patent protection, and overlapping 20-year patent protection and then 95-year copyright protection. And so, you know, the question of, because we have this and because we do have a lot of software development and because we do have startups going on, and of course startups aren't going to be sued until, you know, they become successful enough to be either threatening to a large company that has patents or a target for a troll. You know, so because those sort of things happen, doesn't mean alone that, oh, well, there's no problem here, let's all go back about our business, right? So there's lots of economies that have GDP growth, have industry and whatnot, but some of them grow much faster than others. And what I'm really interested in my work is, how do we have that faster growth? How do we have the maximum innovation with the minimum cost associated with it? And so to simply say, well, this works okay and we get this much, which is a good amount in the U.S., better than anywhere else in the world, really, right? That's great, but is it the best we can do? And I think that's the kinds of questions that are worth asking here. And I still, you know, I don't think I've heard the answer other than, well, this is fine, we do it everywhere else, it's okay. The fact is, we do have choices about what we give patents for, now that we have interesting questions of international law about treaty obligations to treat all sort of subject matter the same. And those admittedly would present problems, but we have choices about this, and it's not a bad idea, and it's certainly rational to evaluate those choices from the point of view of trying to figure out what actually gives us the best benefit for the cost. That's the underlying point that I'm trying to make. And my overarching point is that we've gotten to the place where we are with double protection of software, not through a carefully thought out kind of cost-benefit analysis, but by the very accretion that Bob's kind of talking about, and by the very kind of property rights application without, I think, enough careful thought. Not on Adam's part, he's a careful thinker, but in general. And so I think that's what's problematic, because, of course, at the end of the day, the patents on and copyrights are non-rivalrous goods, right? The idea of how to code something, that functionality Bob was talking about, is not something that only one person can enjoy. Lots of people can copy it freely. The question is, how much protection do we need to give before we allow other people to copy it freely? And that's, you know, just a very utilitarian question that we should try to answer much better than we do as a society.
I think overprotection is the order of the day. You want to talk about overprotection, I think the Copyright Act is a perfect example of that. I mean, first of all, we have the unending copyright extension for Mickey Mouse, which will live on forever, immortally under a copyright, and yet every possible variation of a given work is subject to copyright. So you have derivative works, and you have translations, and you have, you know, you can put it on the web. That's a different, you know, you get every copyright variation you can think of. That's extending the power of copyright far, far more, I would argue, than the equivalent in the patent domain. And then, of course, the intersection between copyright and trademark, right? So Disney's marks and their copyrights, and you can copyright short, tiny expressions. You know, we deliver on time. You can register that as a trademark. So there's plenty more overlap and overextension of a taking of the commons.
We're at the top of the hour. However, we're happy to continue for a few more minutes. Dean, are there any additional questions?
There are not.
Okay. I would suggest that perhaps rather than get off on a discussion of copyright, that perhaps each of you consider a few brief remarks, concluding remarks. Robert, would you like to say a few remarks in conclusion?
Sure. So the question is, bane or boon, I think is it cast as an utilitarian question, and very much, you know, is this a good thing? And the problem, I think, in asking it and answering it is because it looks to the effects, it's not necessarily, I believe, in a first principles analysis. And I believe in protecting, you know, following kind of the core thought that patents protect functionality, protect the value driven by functionality. And software is one mechanism of many by which functionality is delivered. And that's what consumers writ large, and I mean both from individual users to corporate enterprises, seek to pay for in the marketplace is that functional value. And I don't take a natural rights approach to that. I do take a property rights approach and the thought that if you have invented new functionality, that should be protected against free riders who may make use of that functionality at a lower at a cost to compete unfairly. So I take a first principles approach. I agree the patent system in general has lots of structural and doctrinal problems. I don't think that's different from any other legal system we have. It's a living, breathing entity, so to speak, and will evolve. But the notion, but I just take fundamental issue, the notion that we need to throw out software patents. They're not inventions to begin with. It's not inventive. They're not the kinds of things that should be protected, and that we have adequate, everything else is adequate for that, gets you on a very slippery slope of making ex ante determinations as to what technology shall we protect and what technology shall we not. And the nature of 101, I believe that 101, Section 101, is fundamentally different than any other statute in the entire body of law, intellectual property or otherwise, in that it looks to the future. It looks to the unknown. It says, bring us your inventions. Bring us the things which we cannot even conceive of. Bring it to us, and we shall, you know, protect it. And in that, if you look at it from an open-ended standpoint, it makes sense that you can't ex ante. You can't decide ahead of time what will be patentable and what be not. Now, if Congress wants to make that determination, so be it. But it's not something for the courts at this point to start legislating by doctrinal variation and say, you know, it's not patentable because of it's an abstract idea or what have you. If Congress wants to make the policy determination, that's Congress's business. I think it would be a wrong determination, but it would be one that Congress can make and that, you know, obviously is we would respect.
Thank you, Robert. David Olson, your concluding remarks.
Yes, so I've enjoyed this discussion. I think it shows that we're going to have ongoing action here. And to Adam's earlier point, I don't think any bill will get through Congress, this next Congress, or for a few, because we see it takes a long time for patent laws to kind of the sides to line up and get things through. I could be wrong, but I don't think there'll be any major law that will affect software patents. But I do think eventually, I think this issue is going to stay out there because it is problematic for so many industry players and because the theoretical basis for it is not well founded. I think we'll continue to argue about this. So hopefully this discussion is somewhat helpful along those lines. As far as a couple of points, first, Bob said that he's interested in first principles, in patents protecting the value driven by functionality and in protecting against free riders and their ability to compete at a lower cost. So baked into that is an assumption, and that's that there are these free riders out there who can compete at a lower cost, that even though there's software protection, even though there's copyright protection, so you can't copy someone else's code, you can't get the source code, even though there are first mover advantages to being the person who kind of gets out there and owns the space and makes the reputation, there's an assumption that other people could come in and compete at a lower cost. And I just want to point that out, that that's an assumption. Sometimes that'll be true, and many times it may not be true, and we should keep that in mind. Overall, I guess the point I'd say we should I'd like to leave people with is I think that this probably is a role for Congress. It would be hard at this point for the judiciary to come in and lop off software patents. But you know, I think it's worth the investigation. I don't know if that can happen with any of our recent or current Congresses. But I think it's worth the investigation into, and I would just leave the listener and my panelists with the question, what's the world look like without software patents? Is it so different? Is it so wrong? Is it Armageddon, or is it, or even as Bob said, with shorter software patents, is it something that might be as good as or better? Thank you.
Thank you, David. And now I hand it off to Adam Mossoff for his concluding remarks.
Thank you. And I would just like to reiterate the point that I made in my opening remarks that copyright cannot and does not secure the value and the function of the invented product that is represented by software today. To make a rough kind of simplistic analogy, a word processor is a digital typewriter. And it is not the function of copyright to secure typewriters. It's the function of the patent system to secure products like typewriters. And in fact, it's somewhat moot to say you can't access someone's source code because it's held by trade secret or it's protected, because you don't need to copy source code anymore to copy the user interface, which represents the functionality of the program, which is exactly the point that why copyright does not secure the value in the invented product that is being commercialized in the market and sold to users and downloaded over the internet. And this is really why the argument about overlapping protection is not really relevant. And while I get the point that you might have, and it's certainly conceivable that you could potentially have overprotection from overlapping legal protection by different legal regimes, not obvious, and it's not necessarily the case. In fact, we have lots of overlapping legal protections by different legal regimes in lots of areas of our lives. Our homes are protected by property law, are protected by contract law, are protected by tort law, and yet we don't say, oh, we have overprotection of our homes. We have a problem here because there's overlapping protections by different legal regimes. Overlapping protection of different legal regimes leads to the question of why do you have that? And I think, as I explained in my historical remarks, the reason why you have it is because ultimately the regimes are protecting different things, different values. And at the end of the day, I think it's really important just to kind of point out, because David has rightly made this argument that the Constitution is a utilitarian system for IP. Actually, he rightly made this argument. He has made this argument, and he's argued for it as a right proposition in his scholarship. And in our debates before, but I don't think that that's necessarily the case. If the Constitution had said to promote the progress of social utility, or to maximize overall social utility, I would entirely agree that the Constitution is utilitarian. And in fact, utilitarianism existed at the time the Constitution was drafted, so they knew those phrases from Bentham and from other utilitarians. But it says promote the progress, and promote the progress is just as consistent with natural rights theory as it is with utilitarian theory, for the same reason that the Declaration of Independence, which is a natural rights document, talks about the right to pursue happiness, which was not made as a utilitarian claim, but was made as a natural rights claim. So I don't agree that with the underlying assumption that you have to have established with full effect a pure cost-benefit analysis to prove that something is maximizing social utility before you grant property protection to it, I think that you need to, that there is a, the presumption is if you've created a new invention, that it is secured, and that if you can show that it doesn't meet the requirements of the patent system, then you don't secure it. So thank you.
Well, Mark, this is Dean Reuter. Let me close things out here on behalf of the Federalist Society. I want to thank Professors Schultz, Mossoff, Olson, and Mr. Robert Sachs for joining us today. A reminder to our audience, I hope you'll join us for our next scheduled Teleforum conference call November 20th, but until that time, we are adjourned. Thank you, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.